I got out of the army, I had been studying West Indian music and became very much involved in that area of a music that I had never heard before. So I decided to even make attempts of imitating some of the calypso singers in the West Indies.
Yeah.
And so much so that I had a group that accompanied me. And while I was there, a song called Matilda was very enchanting to me. That was a public domain at that time. I didn't know what the word public domain meant at the time. I was just a young kid. But it intrigued me because my sister's name is Matilda. And I decided, let's do something with this song. As among other songs that, incidentally, that I knew and that I was responsible for having become accepted in the United States. But let me get back to Matilda because there's so many things that I established a group of guys that were in the Air Force with myself that were from in the New York area. And we became known as the Calypso Boys, and I was known as the Calypso Kid.
Okay.
And we'd sing these things at various times when someone needed some entertainment. They would always ask us to perform, and we did, and we always brought the house down. And at that time, I invented the audience participation on the song Matilda that ultimately, as I finally got discharged from the army, I brought to New York City and sang in New York City, and a fellow by the name of Harry Belafonte at one time happened to be in the audience.
Yeah.
And watched me perform with the audience participation. And this was one of those rare times in the industry that one could not really achieve what he wanted to do only because of the fact that the average black musician in the United States didn't know anything about West Indian music, and those that were from the West Indies were black. So I had to use and wanted to use the authentic musicians. And being that it was an integrated group at the time, we couldn't really get anywhere because in those days, integrated groups were not accepted or not used in public performances like they are today. So I was I was handicapped for being white. And ultimately, Harry Belafonte, who incidentally went to the same voice teacher I did, Miriam Spear, in New York City on 54th Street, had known that, you know, I was achieving a certain amount of popularity in Harlem, and latched on to Matilda. The rest is history. I get kidded many times by my friends in Harlem who tell me, you know, how much good I did. But in any case, that was the beginning of my involvement in the music business or in the area of music. Also, I handed a song to, you know, this is dating myself, but I must say I still hold up pretty well. But I gave a song called Rum and Coca-Cola to a fella called Maury Amsterdam,
yeah,
who brought it to the Andrews Sisters, and that's history also. We moved to Norfolk just on a lark. I happened to come down here on vacation to visit my sister and her husband. And at that time, my intention was to move out of New York so that I could have my children maybe grow in an area where one sees trees from time to time.
Yeah, less crowded place. Yeah.
And so I decided to maybe look around. My sister And my mother wanted me to maybe settle in Norfolk. I said, well, the only way I would settle down here, I said, even though I enjoy the climate and so on, is to get into business. And if I do get into business, it will have to be in the music business. Well, she said, let's look in the newspaper and see what there is. And it just so happened there was a record shop up for sale on Church Street. And I asked my sister, well, where is it? She said, it's in the real black section of Norfolk. I said, well, that's great, because I want to learn as much as I can about rhythm and blues. I have really limited knowledge, like so many New Yorkers. We are not that hip to the real black low-down blues and R&B.
What year would this have been, Frank?
This was 1954.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so I bought this record shop, which incidentally wasn't doing very much at the time, and I guess the fellow who sold it to me laughed up his sleeve thinking he just really pulled a great coup. And he did for about 8 months, and then finally I took this store. It was called Frankie's Birdland at the time, and specialized in jazz and rhythm and blues and Latin music, which incidentally I taught the kids on Church Street how to do the mambo, because they never heard of the mambo, didn't know anything about Latin rhythms. So I kind of established a reputation for having the sounds kids wanted, jazz that the jazz buffs wanted. And the record shop served a great purpose, because I learned all about rhythm and blues and became expert in that, and gospel and you name it. Till finally, maybe 2 years went by, and I decided now it's time for me to start recording. And I developed a group called the Sheiks, who I got with Atlantic Records at the time. A very talented group. Unfortunately, the lead singer, who had a great voice, his timing was not as great as it should have been. So we kind of was stunted by that fact, but it didn't deter me. I felt that eventually I would latch on to an idea. Ironically enough, as I think about that, a kid who came into town one time at one of the concerts, I believe Red Foley was on the concert, came in there with jeans, very sloppy looking from what I understand. And as I heard from a black a friend of mine that had seen the show, he said, gee, this white kid was great. And I said, well, what kind of music did he sing? Well, you know, he sang a couple of country songs, but he also sang some soul music. It wasn't known as soul in those days. It was known as R&B. And I said, whoever that kid is, I says, he's going to be a monumental giant in the industry if he sticks to it. And a fellow by the name of Tex Davis brought the show in.
Sheriff Tex, yeah.
And the kid who was on the show was a young kid called Elvis Presley.
Okay.
And the rest is history, because Elvis Presley became a giant doing rhythm and blues, such as Hound Dog and you name it. So it was a throwback thinking about the Sheiks, because that all happened at around that time.
How many records did the Sheiks record?
How many records?
Yeah, how many recordings they have released?
Or... 2 records on the Sheiks, because immediately after that, I moved on to other things.
Yeah.
I became a distributor of jazz in the East Coast area, from Washington, D.C. down to South Carolina. And I just was growing, but still growing in directions that really were a necessity rather than an affection or a love. And the opportunity came when a fellow by the name of Bob Story decided to get out of his studio on Princess Anne Road, and I bought the studio. And he told me, well, what are you going to do with the studio? I said, well, 3 months from now, I'm going to have a hit. Well, he thought I was crazy, and I guess everybody else was thought I was crazy. But in less than 3 months, I had a record called New Orleans. I said, hey, 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 yeah. Hey, 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 yeah.
Mississippi down in New Orleans. I tell you, hey.
Oh, yeah.
That
but so much, it would have probably been 10 times the hit it was if it hadn't been so far advanced for its time. Because what we did is we decided we weren't going to use rhythm and blues chord progressions. So many people think that New Orleans was a black record, but actually it wasn't. It was a recording that had so many innovations that... this is one of the reasons why I enjoy interviews, particularly locally, because I like to let the young people in the music business, musicians, aspiring musicians, know that Norfolk, above all areas of the world, was responsible for what is now known as pop music.
For what they're doing, right?
New Orleans, for example, had the beginning of the overmodulated sound, which George Martin, tried to sap my brain as much as he could in 1961, attempting to find out how I got that sound that was so, you know, so big that when you heard it, it hit you in the chest.
Yeah.
That's how it was described. In fact, the New York studios then later, you know, called it the LeGrand sound. And that goes with Bell Sound Studio. All the studios in New York were using and attempting to get the sound we got. But the first one to do it was George Martin. Now, George Martin had been studying my records. And at that time, George Martin was a staff producer, a guy with EMI, which owns Capitol Records. But he did nothing but British records. And England was way behind. They weren't doing a blessed thing in the industry at that time. Until I brought a record over there called New Orleans, and they studied it. And as a result of Martin's great interest in what we were doing in Norfolk, between the Beatles and himself, because I think Martin is a genius. I have a tremendous respect for him. I think he was the first one to realize what we had done and took full advantage of it. I Want to Hold Your Hand, and those early Beatles recordings, you can almost see exactly how they did what they did. The double bass drum beat, which incidentally Ringo couldn't play, and they had to get another drummer to do it, because he couldn't execute the double bass drum beat. And the yeah, yeah, yeah came out of Gary, because Gary always said, yeah, yeah, yeah. And the overmodulated sound was George Martin's. And incidentally, it doesn't appear as a coincidence, but the Beatles formed a fan club, the only fan club in the history of the Beatles, formed a fan club for Gary U.S. Burns in Liverpool. And they were our promoters in Liverpool. And whenever the occasion arose that they heard we were coming, they always wanted to back up Gary Burns.
How did you discover him? How did you develop his style?
Well, I knew Gary. I knew most of all the people that went in and out of the store. Actually, what I did in order to make the kids in town realize that things could happen for them in Norfolk, that they didn't necessarily have to go to New York to become successful, I started holding some amateur shows at one of the theaters on Church Street. And it used to pack people in. The owners of the theater wanted something to bring people into the theater, and they decided to allow me to have an amateur show once a week. And this way I was able to find out who could sing and who couldn't sing. Now, Gary never really went into any of those contests. He was with a group called the Turks, but I don't think they did very much as far as the overall group. There were other groups that were better, but Gary had a very high-pitched voice, and he had a terrific appearance, clean cut. And I decided that when I wrote and decided to do a thing called New Orleans, that if it became a hit and people could see what the kid looked like, that it would enhance the sales, and ultimately he'd become a big star. And it proved to work out just that way. It took off, and I think after Gary made the Dick Clark shows, the record took off like mad. And that was he performed it with a group called the Turks, and a local musician called Sleepy King, who incidentally was quite good. Decided I'd sign Gary as his personal manager to make sure that his business was conducted in a way where we had no problems. And it worked out fine. We were together for, goodness, 19, 60 to 8 years. And he had a string of many, I think, good hits.
talk about Church Street 5.
Church Street 5?
Yeah. You developed them before you developed Gary U.S. Brown.
Oh, yeah.
Didn't you?
Yeah.
By what time frame? How many years before?
That was 1960. But I had known a few of the musicians before. Let's see, there was Leonard Fox, Willie Burnell, a fellow by the name of Butts. Get his first name right now. Earl Swanson and Nab Shields with my Church Street 5. A year later, a fellow by the name of Gene Bartsch, who became known as Daddy G later on, he joined our group because he decided to settle back in the Virginia area. I guess he had had enough of travel and show business and decided he would come back. And so I used Earl Swanson on New Orleans, but the Church Street 5 can be heard in Junior Walker. I mean, if you listen to Junior Walker, that was... Junior Walker, the All-Stars, did a... and all those people in Macon, Georgia, and the Alabama area, they all had their answer to the Church Street 5. And the reason we call the Church Street 5 the Church Street 5 is because we were all from the Church Street area, and I knew that there was a Church Street in every town in the world.
Yes, it was synonymous, and everybody could identify with it.
Yeah, right. But they were all extremely talented, and in fact, we had several that I utilized from Hampton and Newport News. There was a guitar player by the name of Wayne Beckner, who I believe has a son that's playing around this area, Beckner. It was a fantastic guitarist, and then there was another incredible musician called Eric Sauls, who... could execute anything you asked them to. So our efforts and what we accomplished in Norfolk were not unique to Norfolk. Some of our best musicians came from Newport News and Hampton. And so I don't want to give the impression that Church Street 5
that it's always on that side,
you know, from that side of the water. In fact, If You Want to Be Happy was an exclusive Newport News group. Rockin' Cabanas were from Newport News, and I recorded If You Want to Be Happy with them and left the part open for my tenor sax to come in, and then we overdubbed the tenor sax on If You Want to Be Happy. But that entire music group were from Newport News. And don't you know that Otis Redding, who was an unknown artist at the time, although he did travel through the states, I mean through Virginia and North Carolina, picked up the band and took them on the road with it. I worked with another group that I was very much impressed with at the time. One kid looked like the All-American Boy, so I decided if I was going to make it with a new artist, I would concentrate on this young man. And eventually he made it. We worked real hard to do that. And that group was Bill Beal and the Rondells. Couldn't hit the high notes, so I used to teach them voice technique. And Ammon, who had a good high-pitched voice, could hit the high notes that Bill couldn't hit. And I had that group work with them for a good 5 years. There are many, many people that came out of the area that we worked with. General Johnson, for example, was a Norfolk talent.
Jimmy Soul's one of my favorites.
Well, I'm glad you said that because I think If You Want to Be Happy is one of my favorites. And incidentally, you can hear If You Want to Be Happy in the new movie Chances Are with Cybill Shepherd. And you can also see it if you get a chance to see Michael Keaton in Clean and Sober. It's in that movie also.
Hey!
The most popular song we've ever had anything to do with because it's been translated into every known language in existence. But how it happened, very interesting. I gave the song to Gary Bonds first. And Gary... Well, I gave... No, I'm sorry. Let's go back. Twistin' Matilda to Gary. And Gary listened to it. And he said, well, you know, I don't think it has any soul. Well, I said, that's fine, but Gary always did this whenever we got into the studio. Almost anything I gave him, really, unless it sounded like Little Willie John, he would not particularly like. He would execute fantastic. But in order to get him to sing a song, I had to go through many problems in letting him know that I felt this was commercial at the time. Well, he didn't like Matilda, Twistin' Matilda. Notice, I recorded Twistin' Matilda many, many years after Belafonte in order to let the world know that he didn't own that song.
That's right, yeah.
And it became a hit. We sold close to 700,000 copies on it. It made, made much noise all over. One of the members of the Church Street Five who told me about Jimmy, and I said, well, bring him over. And I listened to him, and he had a fantastic falsetto, and it worked fine for Twistin' Matilda. And I deliberately changed his name to Jimmy Soul because Gary had told me the song didn't have any soul, so I was just being cute.
Yeah.
And that was the first time the word soul, incidentally, was used in the name.
Yeah.
And it became a hit. And then the next song, If You Want to Be Happy, needless to say, I don't think anybody could have performed it like Jimmy did.
No.
Lennis Guess. You might say Lennis Guess is probably one of the most all-around talented people I've ever known. And I recognize this in Lennis because I wanted him to become my protege. I wanted to make him a producer because I thought he had the talent to do that. You know, many artists can sing and many artists can write, but to produce is not the easiest thing.
That's true. Was Working For My Baby his first
Working
recording.
For My
was
Baby.
Was that his first
once
recording?
Again, yes, Working For My Baby. If you'd listen to it, here I had a real black artist singing something that had absolutely nothing to do with rhythm and blues.
Yeah.
The chord progressions to Working For My Baby were Latin. One could classify them classical, Spanish or Italian or French, in a classical mode. If you listen to the chord progressions, they are absolutely beautiful. Been the case with my recordings. My, for example, Lennis Guess's records sold to the white kids in town.
Oh, yeah.
Black kids didn't understand the chord progressions, didn't understand the... and that's another throwback. I must tell you, this is a very interesting story I'm going to give you, tell you right now. When we were doing these things in 63 with Jimmy, I did a thing called In My Little Room with Jimmy. I don't know if you listened
to that. Yes, I have, yes.
But that was the beginning of the Motown sound insofar as Diana Ross. The chord progressions from In My Room, Baby, Baby, Where Did Our Love Go?
Yeah.
I mean, everybody kidded us that in Detroit, Motown had our records on the turntable whenever they did a session. Smokey Robinson and Holland Dozier and Holland will all attest to the fact that we influenced them tremendously.
The tenor sax man, Gene Barge. Oh, let's get back first to Emmett Shields, the drummer who invented the double bass drum beat. That wasn't an easy thing to accomplish, you know. Everybody that plays drums hits on somebody else all the time. But what the late Nab Shields did, was unique. I mean, you listen to a record that came out prior to 1960, and you will never hear the double bass drum beat.
Yeah, that's true.
Okay?
That's true.
Nowhere at all. And, in fact, if you listen to our recordings, you will also hear Daddy G, or Gene Barge, who I gave that name to. His tenor sax sound was unique also, to the point that everybody in Philadelphia studied Gene Barge. And I must tell you, Clarence Clemons would still be somewhere following bands or in Chesapeake if it hadn't been for the fact that he was from Chesapeake and he knew Gene Barge. Everybody attempted to imitate Gene Barge. So our tenor sax sounds are something else we can talk about that influenced musicians throughout the world. years ago. I didn't have to tell people who, you know, our musicians were, what the names of the members of the Church Street Five were. They knew it. I think that most people who were in the music business are surprised to find out that record manufacturers and executives will say, oh, you're from Norfolk, huh? Because they know what happened here in Norfolk. Yeah. Unfortunately, the kids in town don't really have any idea as to the extent and the influence that this area had on the industry internationally.
Probably not at the time when it was happening, too, I would think.
My advice to the young people and musicians to attempt to be unique and create their own image musically, and eventually things will come their way.
That's right.
But if they are rubber stamps and imitating other people out there, they'll never really accomplish much.